Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The following time has been purchased by the McCarthy Broadcast Dinner Committee for a political address by Senator Joseph R. McCarthy of Wisconsin. This broadcast originates in the grand ballroom of the Palmer House in Chicago, where more than 1,200 American citizens have gathered to honor their distinguished guest, the junior senator from Wisconsin. Senator McCarthy will be introduced by General Robert E. Wood. General Wood is general chairman of this dinner committee. Ladies and gentlemen, our distinguished guests have come from all over Illinois, all over the country, from Illinois, from Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana. Now, here is General Wood.
Ladies and gentlemen, Americans everywhere, it's my honor to introduce to you a true American patriot. Citizens, I introduce the senator from Wisconsin, the Honorable Joseph R. McCarthy.
Thank you, fellow Americans. I am deeply grateful, very deeply grateful, to all of you who have made this night possible. We are at war tonight, a war which started decades ago, a war which we did not start, a war which we cannot stop except by either victory or death. The Korean War is only one phase of this war between international atheistic communism and our free civilization. And we've been losing that war since the shooting part of World War II ended, losing it at an incredibly fantastic rate of speed, losing that war at the rate of 100 million people a year. Now, for the past 2.5 years, I have been trying to expose and force out of high positions in government those who are in charge of our deliberate, planned retreat from victory. Now, this fight against international communism should not be a contest between America's two great political parties. Certainly, after all, the millions of Americans who have long voted the Democrat ticket are just as loyal. They love America just as much. They hate communism just as much as the average Republican. Unfortunately, the millions of loyal Democrats no longer have a party in Washington. And tonight I shall give you the history of the Democrat candidate for the presidency who endorses and would continue the suicidal, Kremlin-directed policies of this nation. Now, I'm not going to give you a speech tonight. Tonight I'm a lawyer giving you the facts and the evidence in the case of Stevenson versus Stevens. Now, let me make it clear that I am only covering his history insofar as it deals with his aid to the communist cause and the extent to which he is part and parcel of the Acheson Hiss-Lattimore group. Now, I perform this unpleasant task because the American people are entitled to the coldly documented history of this man who says, "I want to be your president." Now, the issue which faces 150 million American people tonight, very simply stated, is, will communism win or will America win? And you the people who are listening to me tonight on radio, television, here in the hall, we'll decide that issue on November 4th because we shall win or lose depending upon the leadership which we choose on that day. I shall now try to fit together the jigsaw puzzle of the man who wants to be president on the Truman-Acheson ticket. And I don't call the Democrat ticket because it would be a great insult to all the good Democrats in this nation. That which I present to you tonight is only that part of his history on which I have complete, unchallengeable documentation. Now, Stevenson has not yet heard the speech, but already he and his camp are denouncing it as a pack of lies. Tonight I give you the cold record, a full week, a week and a day, before election, so that he may have a chance to explain this record if he can. Now, these facts, my good friends, cannot be answered by streams of smears and lies. These facts can only be answered by fact. We call upon Adley of Illinois to so answer those facts. The time is short, so let me get about the task of looking at his record. The Democrat candidate has said, and I quote him verbatim, he said, as evidence of my direction, I have established my headquarters here in Springfield with people of my own choosing. In other words, he says, judge me. Judge me by the advisors whom I have selected. Good, let's do that. Let's examine a few of those advisors first. First is Wilson Wyatt, his personal manager. Now, Wilson Wyatt is the former head of the left-wing ADA, the Americans for Democratic Action. The ADA has 5 major points in its program. Listen to these and remember them, if you will. Point number 1, repeal of the Smith Act, which makes it a crime to conspire to overthrow this government. Number 2, recognition of Red China. Number 3, opposition to loyalty oaths. Number 4, condemnation of the FBI for exposing traitors like Coughlin and Gorbachev. And number 5, continuous all-out opposition to the House Committee on American Activities. Nothing secret about that platform they publish a day after day. Now, according to an article in the New York Times, may I have that, which I hold in my hand, the Democrat candidate, campaign manager Wyatt, condemned the government's loyalty program, and here's the proof, but condemned the loyalty program in the most vicious terms. But strangely, Adley, Adley in 1952, now that he's running for president, says, I will dig out the communists using as my weapon the loyalty program, which my campaign manager damns and condemns. Next, and perhaps the key figure in the Stevenson camp, is his speechwriter, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., former vice chairman of the same ADA. Now, Schlesinger has been a writer, incidentally, for the New York Post. New York Post, whose editor and his wife admit that they were members of the Young Communist League. Now, in 1946, Stevenson, speechwriter, wrote that the present system in the United States makes, and I quote, listen to this. Here's his speechwriter. He says, the present system in the United States makes even freedom-loving Americans look wistfully at Russia. I wonder if there's anyone in this audience tonight who is looking wistfully at Russia. And I wonder also if some calamity would happen and Stevenson would be elected, what job this man would have. Perhaps the most revealing article written by Stevenson, speechwriter, appeared in the New York Times on December 11, 1949, on page 3, and listen to this if you will, and I quote, he says, I happen to believe that the Communist Party should be granted the freedom of political action and that communists should be allowed to teach in universities. Nothing secret, right? Right, nothing secret about it. It's in the New York Times, December 11, 1949. Stevenson's speechwriter saying, I think that communists should be allowed to teach your children, my good friend. And he says, oh, but judge me by the advisors whom I select. Now let's see how Stevenson's speechwriter feels on the subject of religion. The answer is given in his review of the book of Whittaker Chambers. Whittaker Chambers, the man whose testimony convicted Alger Hiss. Chambers, in his book, as you know, maintained that a belief in God was the hope of the free world, a feeling which most Americans have, regardless whether they're Protestant, Jewish, or Catholic. Well, Schlesinger wrote about that. What did he say? He says this, let me quote him verbatim. He says, the whole record of history indeed gives proof that a belief in God has created human vanity as overweening and human arrogance as intolerable as the vanity and arrogance of the communists. And I say all of these documents are available for my good friends of the press to examine, each and every one of them. As Stevenson says, judge me by the people I choose as my advisors. Here you have the philosophy of his chief advisor, the philosophy of his speechwriter laid bare. This idea, of course, that religion should be ridiculed is one of the basic principles of the Communist Party. Now, if you couple this ridicule of religion with his statement that communists should be allowed to teach your children, and you have a fairly clear portrait of the man. Another of Stevenson's assistants, Richard DeVoto. Now, DeVoto has violently attacked our strongest defense against communism, the FBI. In Harper's Magazine, as reported in the Daily Worker of December 29, 1949, page 7, his man, DeVoto, denounces the FBI as, quote, nothing but college-trained flat-feet. Then he says this, and I would refuse to cooperate with the FBI. Now, the Communist Daily Worker of February 13, 1947, reports that Stevenson's man, DeVoto, headed a group seeking a permit for a meeting for the wife of Gerhard Eisler, the communist who had disappeared behind the Iron Curtain and who, as of tonight, is heading up the anti-communist group in East Berlin. So much for that. The next, one of the men selected by Stevenson as one of his ghostwriters is a man, James Wexler. Now, Wexler and his wife both admit having been members of the Young Communist League, and I hold in my hand an article from the New York Times which states that Wexler is the man who helped Stevenson write the speech, here it is, helped Stevenson write the speech in which Stevenson ridiculed anti-communists as men who hunt for communists in the Bureau of Wildlife and Fisheries. That's a speech also in which he condemned my exposure of communists as low comedy. Well, I just doubt whether the mothers and wives of the 120,000 Korean casualties consider it low comedy. I think they may possibly consider that high tragedy. I'd like to call Mr. Stevens' attention to that. Some light is shed upon the importance of this man in the Stevenson camp by the list of long-distance phone calls between the governor's office in Springfield and this man who says, I belong to the Young Communist League, Wexler. Here's the list of the phone calls between Wexler and the governor's mansion. I will not read it over, but it's available to the press. One of these calls particularly is important. I think this might be called the trigger call, the trigger phone call, made just before Wexler and two others unleashed the smear attack upon Richard Nixon. Another of the men on the Democrat candidate's camp is Archibald MacLeish. Stevenson's biography on page 77 states that MacLeish was the man who brought him into the State Department. It's his own biography. Now Stevenson has him as an advisor. Well, how about this man, MacLeish? He's got perhaps the longest record of affiliation with communist fronts of any man that I have ever named in Washington. And Adley says, judge me by the friends I select. To that I say, amen, Adley, amen. Time is running out. Time is running out, and I'd like to give you more about the people who are guiding Stevenson. But let's go on to other things. In Stevenson's biography, and here's something which I especially call to your attention. In Stevenson's biography, on page 73, we find that in the summer of 1943, it is his own biography, the summer of 1943, after Mussolini's government had fallen, Stevenson was given the task of formulating America's post-war policy in Italy. On page 75, we find the statement that his recommendations were followed in Italy. And Truman was before in a crowd in New York, thank you, New York on Columbus Day, and he confirmed the fact that Stevenson was the man, as Woolsey said, sowed the seeds for the immediate post-war policy in Italy. Well, General Beadle Smith, a fine American, in his testimony and in his book, has told what that foreign policy established by Stevenson was. Listen to this, if you will. He says that foreign policy, here's his testimony, page 35 and 37. He says that foreign policy was to connive to bring communists into the Italian government and to bring the Italian communist leader, Togliatti, back from Moscow. You get the picture of that, my friend? Stevenson says, I was the man who formulated the policy. Truman says, yes, he did. And the head of the Central Intelligence Agency says the policy then was to connive to put communists into the Italian government. Connive and to bring Togliatti, the communist leader, back from Moscow, which they did. Keep in mind that Beadle Smith had nothing to do with this program. He was just testifying as what it was. Now I know that one of the defenses of this will be raised by the Stevenson camp tomorrow will be that, well, Eisenhower was in charge of the European military forces at that time. But Stevenson knows, his camp followers know, you know and I know that Eisenhower had nothing to do with formulating State Department policy. He had the task. He had the task of winning the war in Europe with a loss of the smallest amount of bloodshed and lives, and he did that job very well. Let us pick up another piece of the jigsaw puzzle of Stevenson's history. On September 23rd of this year, Admiral Stanton, who was a holder of the Medal of Honor, signed a statement covering his experience with Stevenson after he, Stanton, had been assigned to the task of enforcing Public Law 151 and removing the communists from the radios aboard our ships. Well, Stevenson was a special assistant at that time in the Navy Department. He called Admiral Stanton to his office, and here's the affidavit given to us by Stanton about that meeting. It hasn't been used until tonight. Let me read just one paragraph from it. He says, on arrival, Stevenson told me that he had received 6 or 8 of the communist cases which my board had recommended for removal, and that he wanted to discuss them with me. Still quoting the Admiral, Stevenson said that he could not see that we had anything against them and stated that we should not be hard on the communists. The conference ended with Stevenson disagreeing with our recommendations to fire the communists. This was in 1943, my good friends, and 2 or 3 days ago, Stevenson went on the air and said, in 1943, I was warning about the dangers of communism in the Mediterranean. Well, immediately after, Stanton appeared at Stevenson's office and said, Mr. Stevenson, get rid of those communists. The law provides you must. And he said, no, what happened to Stanton? He was retired to inactive duty. And another part of the jigsaw puzzle of Stevenson's history is his membership over many years on the Central Committee of the World Citizens Association. Now, I know that you may find some good people in that organization. You may even find some good Republicans. But Stevenson was not merely a member of the group. Stevenson was one of the 12-man policy-forming committee. Now, this is quite enough, really quite enough. But time is so short, I'll only cover plank 5 in their platform. I hold their platform in my hand. Keep in mind that the 12 men, including Stevenson, drafted this platform. Let me read plank number 5. National states must be subordinate to world civilization. Their jurisdiction must be limited by world law, and any local legislation contrary to world law must be null and void. Now, what does this mean, my good friends? What does this mean to the 150 million American people? It means that a world organization, such as the United Nations, could veto any state or federal law or any part of our Constitution. This becomes doubly significant in view of the recent revelations that 12 of the men who were recommended by the State Department to the United Nations have been dropped because they refused to say under oath whether or not they had been members of the Communist Party. 12 of the men in this world organization which should have the power to veto your laws. Well, while Stevenson's own office has been stating that he was a member of this unusual organization for only 1941, I have here a copy of Who's Who, which he gives them a signed statement admitting he was a member up until 1945. I have a copy of the letterhead of this organization, February 1948, carrying Stevenson not as a member but as part of the Central Committee, 12-man governing body. Well, why is this significant? Simply, my friends, simply because you're asked to elect a presidential candidate who proposed to fly the flag of a super world government over the stars and stripes. But let's move on to another part of the jigsaw puzzle. Now, while you may think that there could be no connection between the debonair Democrat candidate and a dilapidated Massachusetts barn, I want to show you a picture of this barn, then explain the connection. Here's the outside of a barn. Give me the picture showing the inside, if you will. Here's the outside of a barn up at Lee, Massachusetts. Looks like it couldn't house a farmer's cow or goat, the outside. Here's the inside. A beautifully paneled conference room with maps of the Soviet Union. Well, in what way does Stevenson tie up with this? My investigators went up and took pictures of this barn after we'd been tipped off as what was in it. Tipped off that there was in this barn all of the missing documents from the Communist Front IPR. The IPR which had been named by the McCarran Committee. Named before the McCarran Committee as a cover shop for communist espionage. But we went up and we found in the room adjoining this conference room 200,000 of the missing IPR documents. The hidden files showing the vouchers, among other things, showing money from Moscow and the entire interlocking group of communists. And Senator McCarran's committee, unanimously a committee of 4 Democrats and 3 Republicans, committee of 4 Democrats, 3 Republicans, unanimously found that the IPR was communist-controlled, communist-dominated, and taping our foreign policy. Now let's take a look at a photostat of a document taken from that Massachusetts barn. One of those documents that was never supposed to have seen the light of day. Rather interesting it is. This is the document which shows that Alger Hiss and Frank Coe recommended Adlai Stevenson to the Mont-Tremblant Conference, which was called for the purpose of establishing foreign policy, post-war foreign policy in Asia. Now, as you know, Alger Hiss is a convicted traitor. Frank Coe has been named under oath before congressional committees 7 times as a member of the Communist Party. Why do Hiss and Coe find that Adlai Stevenson is the man they want representing them at this conference? I don't know. Perhaps Adlai knows. We now come to the much discussed testimony by Adlai Stevenson in the trial of Alger Hiss. Now, my good friends, I have not considered this fact standing alone as overly important in the Stevenson record. It is only a link in the chain of events which prove the case in Stevenson versus Stevenson. Now, what does impress me, however, is the deathly fear that Governor Stevenson displays when additional links tying him to Alger Hiss are brought forth. We find that he very cleverly attempts to imply that his knowledge of Hiss was casual, remote, and that he was not vouching for Hiss's character at the trial. Now, I hold in my hand a petition which has never been made public before either, in the New York courts, a petition by the Hiss lawyers when they asked the court to admit Stevenson's statement. You recall Stevenson said, I will sign a statement, but I will not go to New York and run the risk of being put under cross-examination. Let me read this one small section, this affidavit to you. And the entire affidavit is available to the press. Here's the affidavit of his lawyer. Governor Adlai Stevenson of Illinois has been closely associated with Alger Hiss in the course of certain international diplomatic undertakings. They were together at the San Francisco Conference of the United Nations, at which the Charter of the UN was adopted. And they were also together at the London Conference, which preceded and prepared the agenda for the San Francisco Conference. They say this, the testimony of Governor Stevenson would be of great importance to Alger Hiss. Now I want you to examine closely the statement Governor Stevenson made at Cleveland, Ohio, about 2 days ago, the 23rd, which he attempted to defend his support of the reputation of Hiss. Hiss, the arch traitor of our time. Stevenson said this last Thursday. I quote him. He said, I said his reputation was good. I did not say that his reputation was very good. Now here we have a man who says, I want to be your president, claiming that Hiss's reputation was good, but not very good. Now I say, my good friend, that if he had such misgivings, he should not have vouched for Hiss at all. There are no degrees of loyalty in the United States. A man is either loyal or he's disloyal. There is no such thing. There is no such thing as being a little bit disloyal or being partly a traitor. Now I note that the television man is holding up a sign saying 30 seconds to go. I have much, much more of the documentation here. I'm sorry we can't give it to our television audience, and I want our audience to know it is not the fault of the television stations. We've only arranged for half an hour, and that half an hour is about up. But with your permission, my good friends, when we go off the air, I would like to complete for this audience the documentation.
As time purchased for this broadcast has now elapsed, we regret we will be unable to bring you the balance of Senator McCarthy's address. This has been a paid political broadcast sponsored by the McCarthy Broadcast Dinner Committee. This is the world's largest network, the Mutual Broadcasting System.